This is Flossie for the People with Stephen Birch from Ben Burgess, and we are doing our 87th episode on compatibilism this week.
Yeah, which is amazing because there have only been like 38 total essays in the Substack, and not all of them were about compatibilism. But it turns out that that's actually compatible with 87 of them being about compatibilism.
There's space for there to be 87 videos about compatibilism. Yeah, I'm sure you're excited because I've got new takes today. And I guess also new takes on what Zizo says. But in scary dark news, you can't even tell. I've got a boo-boo chat. I just cut my finger before we started streaming.
If you want to
get up. It's slightly redder.
If you want to get up and wash that off, you know.
I think it's cool.
All right.
Last week, Ben was talking to Zizek.
Yeah, so we played most of this on the show on Monday. Had to pre-record it because Ljubljana is at least 87 hours or so ahead of Los Angeles. Did end up having to cut off like the last 36 minutes just for time on Monday, but we'll release the whole thing to patrons this coming Friday when they would ordinarily be getting
Zizek, uncut, uncensored.
Exactly. And then a couple weeks later we'll release it for everybody. But a really wide-ranging conversation as you tend to have with the man, goes all over the place. So there's a bunch of stuff toward the end. We actually kind of cut off during this about Israel-Palestine and, you know, one states, two states, etc. There's stuff in there about, Argentina. There's a lot about, you know, sort of freedom in the political sense. And there's also stuff about free will and quantum physics and whether there's any relationship whatsoever between the two. And this is the point where we did end up having kind of an extended friendly debate about this, basically, as is going to come out here, I liked his 2012 position, not his 2023 position. On that, you know, and we'll get into what the, you know, what the difference is as far as I can tell. Thought it might be fun for this one rather than, you know, just you and I talking. Sorry, getting the plate out of the way so the cat doesn't knock it over. You and I talking about my essay about me talking to Zizek.
Bring in Zizek. He's waiting in the wings.
Yeah. Come on, Slavoj. It's like the old Jerry Springer episodes. You know, we've got backstage. Rather than doing that, we can. No, Jeb, to assure you, it was not just Zizek saying and so on for 36 minutes. Rather than doing that, maybe we could streamline the process a little bit by talking, you know, about by actually watching some of this discussion and talking about, pausing it and talking about what we're watching. If you're a text fiend, we have a link to the essay itself, of course, down below the box that you're watching, as always. But yeah, might be a fun way to sort of ground this. To actually watch some of the discussion rather than just hearing me describe it. So I think we're going to pick up here. This is just like a minute or two before the most relevant part, but it leads into it.
We are now doing the most degenerate activity on YouTube, which is reacting to a YouTube video on YouTube.
It's a very simple point. We already talked about how here, I think we who still want to be some kind of socialists, whatever we call it, not so much oppose liberalism, but go a little bit deeper and fully accept the fact that our freedom needs to be embedded in certain social circumstances for our freedoms to be actual freedoms. You know, for example, I don't know if I mentioned it in this book of mine, but that was the problem with, it was very limited, but nonetheless, it was a minimal something, Obamacare. Remember what was the right-wing populist counterpoint? Ah, so now the state will prescribe to us, to each doctor, blah, blah, blah. This is the general tendency, and it's an ingenious trick of, let's call it bourgeois ideology, to present us new actual limitations of our freedom as new freedoms. You know who is the best example here? He's almost my favorite guy. You know, when I say this, I mean pure horror, of course, no? You know, this guy, Milei, the new Argentinian president, he brought the notion of freedom to the end. You know, when he was asked how to help the poor, he said, by extending our freedoms to make it fully legal to sell your children and your organs. In some abstract sense, this is a freedom, but thanks for such a freedom. So my point is this one, that if you look, sorry, I don't hear you, do something. Hello?
Oh, sorry, I just said it's a certain kind of freedom from limitation, you know, from constraint, but it's... But if what you care about is freedom from domination or ability to sort of conduct your life as you would like, then yes, the idea of a world where people are, I suppose, selling their organs for Bitcoin so they can, you know, make rent seems like about as extreme a form of domination as I can imagine. Yes. So I did just want to briefly, if it's okay, circle back to the more philosophical point that you started with about before you started talking about social freedom, you know, when you were talking about freedom in general and you were talking about the sort of classical kind of freedom and determinism issue. And and what I wanted to ask about here is I was a little bit curious about how some of what you said about it in this book lines up with some of what you'd said before, because you... In this book, you'd sort of talk about, you seem to take very seriously the idea that these challenges from physics really make it seem like, you know, maybe we just don't have free will at all. You sort of frame it as like a Pascal's wager, you know, kind of issue to affirm that, you know, that we can be even in the face of it. Whereas I remember in your previous book, one like, I don't know, 10 years ago, the Less Than Nothing, you'd said something I always thought was interesting in there. If it's okay, I just want to read this out. You said, compatibilists such as Daniel Dennett have an elegant solution to the incompatibilist complaints about determinism. When incompatibilists complain that our freedom cannot be combined with the fact that all our acts are part of the great chain of natural determinism, they secretly make an unwarranted ontological assumption. First, they assume that we, the self, the free agent, somehow stand outside of reality. Then they go on to complain about how they feel oppressed by the notion that reality determinism controls them totally. This is what is wrong with the notion of us being imprisoned by the chains of natural determinism. We thereby obfuscate the fact that we are part of reality, that the possible local conflict between our free striving and external reality that resists it is a conflict inherent in reality itself. That is to say, there's nothing oppressive or constraining about the fact that our innermost strivings are predetermined. When we feel threatened in our freedom by the pressure of external reality, there must be something in us, some desire or striving that is thus thwarted. But where do such strivings come from, if not that same reality? Our free will does not in some mysterious way disturb the natural course of things. It is part and parcel of that course. For us to be truly and radically free, in quotation marks, would entail that there's no positive content involved in our free act. If we want nothing external in particular to govern our behavior, then this would involve being free from every part of ourselves. What a determinist claims that our free choice is determined, that does not mean that our free will is sometimes constrained. somehow constrained, that we are forced to act against our will. What is determined is the very thing that we want to do freely, that is, without being thwarted by external obstacles. And so I was just curious if you know, in the years since yeah. you'd written that, if your thinking about this has shifted, and if so, kind of what caused that shift?
I'm not aware. Maybe I'm always too much immersed into what I'm doing now, and you from a slightly external perspective can see it. But my basic solution is an old mantra, too philosophical to go in detail into it now. But my point is that the moment you accept the standard naturalistic vision of reality as something totally determined by natural laws, and if you include contingency, as in quantum physics, this doesn't change a lot. Because, you know, freedom is not contingency. Like, let us say you decide, you say, I have to make a big decision now, but I will leave it to chance. Either a more subtle chance of how quantum superpositions will be, will fall into one determined reality, or more simple, which is not true chance, idea of I will toss a coin, blah, blah, and so on. But this is not freedom. This is simple chance. Freedom is not leaving it to chance. Freedom is a form of determinism. Freedom is, this is what I want to do, and I want to do it. It's not leaving it to chance. So how can we think freedom? Freedom is a determination. Without becoming idealists, without saying there must be another level which is outside material reality. And at that level, in the domain of spirit, we are really free. You know what worries me here, me as an old materialist, that this big disclosures, these big results, the last Nobel Prize for Physics, were precisely the guys who experimentally proved for Bohr against Einstein that two particles that you split, which are correlated, can somehow communicate faster than the speed of light. Classical experiment. Now it was more theoretical. Now it's definitely proven. But here our enemies, New Age spiritualists, enter. They say, Einstein was right in his description of reality, where nothing can move faster than the speed of light. If there is a communication faster than the speed of light between two correlated particles, then this must be a non-material spiritual link. So our material reality is not all that is, and so on and so on. I try precisely to reject this. Okay, to cut a long story short, I think that, that only quantum physics, but correctly interpreted with all these paradoxes, opens up a space for freedom, for what only does
humans there.
Emerges as.
Did you deliberately wear the same outfit?
It's not quite the same outfit, actually.
on this level of Zoom, it looks exactly the same outfit. I was also wondering if I can, like... Nah, it doesn't work. I wonder if I can get it so it's just Zizek and we can just pretend he's here. But I don't think it works.
So this is it's a very similar outfit. The what I'm wearing now is a sports jacket and a Metallica shirt. What I was wearing then was a sports jacket and a Miss Construde shirt, which is actually same color scheme and also a metal band, but sadly less successful one than Metallica, but it's the But the drummer in that band is actually Russell Sobriglia, who is an academic. He's like a literature professor at Seton Hall and has actually done a bunch of things with Zizek and is the person who introduced me to him and all of that stuff. So I thought it'd be funny to, you know, to do the misconstruity t-shirt while I was interviewing Zizek. But yeah, I think I think, you know, you get in that way the basic setup, right, of the
it's funny because for a while I was like, he's not saying what Ben said in the article, he's saying the right things.
Yeah.
You were saying, you know, like freedom is a determination and so on. And that just, and it seemed like you could just really, you know, stop things there. But then you just went on and, you know, actually, and, you know, misunderstanding the results of the Nobel Prize last year or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I am not at all confident that I correctly understand them. So I'm not going to try to weigh in on that.
They misunderstood what was going on in them in the announcement of the Nobel Prize.
Okay.
So I think it's a widespread confusion.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So I guess on that one, I at least have the, you know, sublime Socratic wisdom of knowing that I have no clue. But in any case, so in the middle there, right? So because at the beginning of that clip, I mean, after the Argentina stuff, right, we get on to free will. I sort of say, hey, here's this thing you said in your book, Less Than Nothing in 2012, that I really liked. And from what I can tell, I've actually gone back and read the relevant chapter much more carefully since the interview. But from what I can tell in your new book, you know, Freedom and Disease Without Cure, you seem to be saying these very different things that kind of don't fit together in an obvious way with this. And you're right. In the beginning of his response, he sort of spends a minute sounding very compatibilist. He says well, it's not, I don't want to say that the, you know, freedom is on some other, you know, spiritual level of reality or something. I want to say that, you know, it itself is determination. Okay. Stop there and say, okay, I guess I must have misunderstood somehow. You know, you are saying the same thing in 2023, you were saying 2012. But then at the end, after the, you know, after the you know, parsing of the Nobel Prize, which actually, yeah, you should probably just tell me what it actually was actually for, because that'd be a good thing to know. But like, I have no idea. But in any case, but after that, you know, he sort of says this thing that does get into what we're actually going to be disagreeing about in the rest of the discussion, which is that, you know, something about how like the quantum physics with all of its paradoxes opens up the space for free will, which suggests that however he's currently thinking about what free will is, which is, you know, a big, you know, like, it's, you know, I mean, I think it's got like, you know, he says a bunch of interesting things, but you know, how they all fit together is, you know, is a lot harder to say. But, you know, whatever he's ultimately thinking about is being right. That like, if you start talking about this as something that's, well, the space for this is opened up by, like the results about quantum mechanics or whatever, that certainly strongly suggests that you think
that. Your mic's going a bit weird.
Oh, no.
It's fine now.
I
think you just made me a little bit too far away. You just kind of went a bit submarine.
Okay. but yeah, it makes it sound like, you know, you like this sort of Robert Kane-ish kind of libertarianism about free will, that you think that, you know, you think that like quantum effects in the brain like are sort of, you know, maybe don't add up to free will. We're going to get to that in a minute, but like, at least that if that wasn't happening, if it was all totally deterministic up there, then that would be a big problem for free will, which suggests moving away from the 2012 compatibilist position.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I was thinking about in the essay rather than the video you bring up. Zizek talking about this idea of the big other, and kind of the idea that we're confronted by in kind of our particular moment in postmodernity, like this scientific big other who wants to kind of crush freedom, say there's no freedom, say it can explain everything, that it's the totality of the universe and everything in it. And that these quantum indeterminacies are like kind of in opposition to this, a way for freedom. And I think that's definitely false philosophically because it's not needed. But I do actually think it's true psychologically that there is kind of both projects going on, where there is definitely this project to kind of say this about science, and there's also this resistance, this gap, this space where people will, as you can see in our chat, as you can see all over the internet and so on, where people will stay believing in free will because of this apparent space opened up by quantum indeterminacy, which, you know, is not a philosophical, I don't think it's a way to go, but I think it is psychologically true that this is a thing which keeps people aiming towards freedom as opposed to dismissing it.
Yeah. I think that's definitely right. And one thing that I get into a little bit at the end of this, you know, calling back to my, you know, previous essay back in February about Zizek and compatibilism is that, you know, one sort of important data point here that you need to take seriously is that most people really do, when they first start to think about it, think that it's just like obviously ridiculous to say that we could have free will if everything is determined. I mean, this is, you know, like intro to philosophy students, when they first hear about this idea, will often like reinterpret it in their heads into something that makes more sense to them. Say, oh, you must be saying that, like, even if most things are determined, right, you know, some things can still be free will, right? You know, that, like, that would sort of make sense to them in a way that this doesn't, right? So you do have this like really strong intuition that, you know, I think generally people are going to have, you know, when they're first confronted with that, that it's, you know, that there's some sort of conflict there. And, you know, you can obviously overcome that, right? We both have, but I also think that having overcome it, you do need a theory of it, right? You know, so I kind of try to supply that at the end, right? You know, it's like, well, you know, why is it, right? It's not just like sort of, you know, everybody is stupid, right? This is very, very common appearance that things are this way, that like those ideas don't fit together. And so if it's mistaken, right, you know, we need to kind of say where the mistake comes from. Like if they, that, you know, that's sort of the same way that, you know, if everybody sees things in the same visually misleading way, right, you know, we need some sort of theory of optics that's like, okay, here's why that looks that way to everybody,
I think there's an answer which is clearly related to what you quote Zizek is saying in this article, which is Zizek's example of kind of the movie protagonist, who, you know, gives an example of freedom because you'll have this movie protagonist who will do something, you know, they'll plan, you know, their wedding up until the last day, and then they'll run off and marry the guy that they actually should be with or whatever, you know.
Right.
Against all reason and logic and all previous desire, well, not all previous desires, all previous determinations. And that's kind of a freedom of chaos. But I think what compatibilists are suggesting, and which I think makes sense when you kind of elaborate, and it makes a lot of sense when you kind of argue for it and make it clear, but on the face of it, it seems strange, which is the idea that freedom is actually order. I think that's a weird idea on the face of it, but I think it's definitely true.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe we'll get into this as we go on, but I mean, I think one way of thinking about this is that, you know, for people who know like the various things that like Kant says about free will, there's like a thread of Kant on free will that I think very like the sort of current Zizek stuff very strongly echoes, right? That's the sort of mysterious noumenal kind of freedom. But there's also a thread of what Kant says about free will that, you know, that that sort of leads to you know, what we think, right? That like it's you know, that freedom, you know, that like really strongly links freedom to like practical reasoning. So yeah, I mean, I think there is a sort of persistent and understandable attachment to the idea that that like freedom has a lot to do with spontaneity. I think that, you know, I think it's kind of easy to see where that comes from. You know, yeah, I mean, his actual examples sound like better movies than the, you know, the sort of example you just gave, but the, but like the basic point I think is the same. You know,
he's like definitely knows movies better than me.
Yeah. It's actually the last time I like just pop culture in general. Last time I saw him at Hay this year, you know, the essay starts with a story about the you know, going last year, but the one this year, you know, we had lunch. I think I disappointed him by not having seen The Last of Us. That's, you know, because he had takes,
you should have just been Zizekian and not let the fact that you hadn't seen it
stop me from offering some takes, you know. It's like, oh yeah, no, I'm pretty sure, you know? So I think that that sort of makes sense, right? You know, like it's sort of very, I mean, there's an obvious way in which, like, if I'm sort of, it feels like I'm kind of displaying my freedom more if I'm, you know, hey, look, I can do whatever I want, right? You know, like I'm doing something that you wouldn't think I would do and goes against expectations, whatever. That's like, you know, like I'm doing that. But I think if you're acting, you know, like the kind of freedom, the kind of self-control that I think matters most when you really start thinking about what makes the kind of beings that we really think of as persons who are responsible for their behavior different from other kinds of beings, and why, right? It's not, you know, it's, I don't think it's really so much, I mean, look, you know, my cat, who was on screen a minute ago, regularly engages in spontaneous behavior that I can't make sense of. You know,
right? I mean, I think that's the important thing to clarify, that there are various kinds of freedom, and all of which are kind of legitimate in their use in human language. You know, if you say the cat is free to go out the cat flap, that's true. Yeah. And it's distinct from the sense that I'm free to go out the cat flap.
Yeah. Maybe the point of the cat flap is to make the cat sort of politically free to go out, you know, like that nobody will stop him, but it's not, but you know, doesn't really seem to be the kind of autonomy that we think, you know, means that it's like, you know, it's his own fault, you know, if he did, right? That doesn't seem relevant to that concept, right? So what I, you know, I mean, I think I say some of this, you know, we're going to watch more of it in a minute, but like, I think I say some of this in the discussion, but you know, what I spent a lot more time on in the essay than I was able to in the discussion is just like, okay, what's, you know, if you think about what it is that seems to make, creatures like us, you know, reasonably cognitively standard adult humans, typically seem to be, you know, persons and responsible for our behavior and all that stuff. Whereas we think that, you know, we think that various other kinds of beings, you know, cats, people, you know, very small children, you know, who, you know, we might use the word person for in the sense of like we think they deserve the same moral regard or more, right? But like in the they're not sort of haven't quite come into their personhood and like aren't sort of fully responsible yet, you know, for their behavior.
You should listen to them a lot of the time.
Yes, exactly.
Thinking about like their thoughts, feelings, and desires.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, or, you know, even adults, human beings suffering from certain kinds of mental incapacity or, you know, et cetera, that like, you know, the reason that we think that all these kinds of, you know, beings that I've just mentioned have, you know, diminished responsibility or maybe no responsibility even for for their actions is that, you know, we, you know, I don't think is so much about the capacity for spontaneity, right? That's any less, right? But it's the opposite, right? Like you said, that there's like a certain kind of order that comes from having a, you know, cognitive mechanism that makes you capable of understanding and sort of weighing the importance of and being at least somewhat moved by reasons for and against you know, different courses of action. And that this is this kind of autonomy in terms of you know, of that, you know, kind of practical reasoning, which, you know, doesn't mean that you have to be perfectly rational to have enough control to be responsible for your behavior. You certainly don't, right? But like, you know, there's a certain minimum threshold of capacity in that regard that that does seem to be necessary. That's what really seems to differentiate the kind of creatures that we think of as autonomous, responsible for their behavior, from the ones who aren't, right? So I think that definitely part of the explanation for the intuition you're talking about has to do with this sort of, you know, movie example spontaneity stuff. I ultimately also think that that, you know, the questions that we ask, like, you know, because as you say, there are lots of different senses in which somebody could be free, not just like, you know, politically free versus, you know, free in your head or whatever, but also that there are, you know, different more abstract senses in which you could be free. And, you know, free from what, free to do what, right?
And also like the human freedom's scary.
Sure.
And yeah. Difficult and hard. If you're freed like a cat, then you're not responsible for anything. You can't be held to account for anything. You can't just go about and do whatever you want. And, you know, I see a lot of stuff online where people will express kind of jealousy for dogs and cats, and they'll express jealousy for when they were children.
Sure.
These various times where they didn't really have full human freedom because not having this full human freedom was a relief. And yeah, I think there is this thing of there's the backing away from human freedom, especially in kind of our postmodern time, because, you know, it forces you to confront the fact that you really are thrown in this world, you know, into a world of other human beings, but at the same time kind of ultimately responsible for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that kind of Sartrean, you know, people are very anxious about being free. I think there is, you know, I mean, I think is probably an important point because there's like a certain kind of rhetorical posture that people often adopt when they deny that, you know, free will exists, which is like, look, I've liberated myself from wishful thinking, right? You know, like you've helped yourself to this lovely flattering assumption that, you know, you're a free being, you know, causing things to happen. Whereas I'm, you know, have adopted the coldly rational scientific posture that I know that I'm not. But I think what you're pointing to is like, yeah, slow down there, right? That like, I think there's a big sense in which free will denial can be wish fulfillment in itself, which is actually a very Zizekian point also. That last little reversal, you know, but you can have, that, you know, there's something, you know, there's something comforting about it that, you know, that you're avoiding this, you know, this kind of responsibility. I, you know, I think that's totally right. And you know, I think it's even linked to the ways that sort of expanding, you know, social and political freedom can be, you know, can be scary. I remember Nick Stang, philosophy professor, a Kant scholar, had sort of jokingly making this point to me many years ago that it's like, look, there's something that's like, at least under feudalism, you know, you know, it's like genuinely not your fault, you know, what happens to you, you know, that there's something like if you're born under capitalism, at least in sort of like a sort of middle class minimum of comfort, then like suddenly, you know, you get much more neurotic because, like, you know, you actually fucked up by not, you know, by not rising higher, you know, in the social structure, right? And there's probably a parallel point to be made about capitalism and socialism, that if you have that like sort of greater social freedom, actually giving people more autonomy,
and now in post-modernity we're poor, but people will tell you on Twitter that you're perpetrating the Palestinian genocide if you're not posing enough.
Yes, you haven't posted your way to stopping it yet. This, which is really funny, because that's also the sort of the flip side of all of the, you know, why haven't you condemned Hamas people? That you know, it's all like always. I made this joke when they did the stream with Jason and Trey and Catherine Liu before Halloween to talk about horror movies, somehow started talking about Israel at the end. And I asked Catherine if she condemned Hamas, and she, you know, actually seemed to get a little nervous for a second. It's like, I was like, okay, well that's good. Right. Cause I'm pretty sure that somewhere in Gaza, in like, I mean, this was weeks ago, and at this point, you know, even this is sort of things have gotten much grimmer than this, but it's like, I'm sure somewhere in Gaza in the ruins of a bombed out apartment block, somebody's putting together a rocket propelled grenade right now. And if somebody ran up to them and said, no, my friend, you have to stop. Catherine Liu has condemned you. Right. Then like,
yeah, you would start unscrewing it.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, in any case, you know, circling back to the point, you know, I condemn it all for whatever it's worth, which is absolutely nothing. But circling back to the point about this, that I think I think there's like a kind of psychological motivation we talked about. I think you're right about the spontaneity and order thing. But I also think like a big part of where this intuition comes from, this intuitive appearance that free will is incompatible with determinism, is that because there are all these different, you know, senses of freedom, some of which surely are compatible with determinism and some of which are not. And we sort of have to sort out which are which and which matter for other important concepts like personhood and responsibility. I think the framing of the questions that we ask, you know, since most people are not, you know, super attuned to the difference, because that fact requires no explanation. I mean, most people, you know, philosophy is hard. Most people aren't making like super fine grained conceptual distinctions in their heads most of the time. So I think that the framing of the questions that we ask about free will invites us to sort of default to one or another, you know, kind of freedom that we're thinking about, one or another sort of conception, and, you know, without necessarily clearly distinguishing it from the rest. So I think if you're sort of in context of kind of ordinary everyday attributions of responsibility, then we tend to default to something that's, you know, very much like the kind of compatibilist approach to free will we've been talking about, that we generally think that cognitively typical adult human beings are responsible for things. You know, we might even explain why, you know, in ordinary non-philosophical context by saying, well, you know, look, you did that of your own free will, right? You know, you decided to do that, right? Nobody made you. Whereas when we ask the so that's how we would answer the question, you know, is it, you know, John's fault that, you know, he that he slept with, you know, Jim's wife or whatever, right? That's like in that sort of context, right? Then it's like we very quickly default to that. Whereas if you radically switch the context by saying, is free will compatible with physical determinism, then I think you've invited people to do this really deep context switch, where it's like suddenly we're not talking about the sort of factors that we ordinarily think are relevant to the kind of free will.
Yeah, and I mean, no one ever brings up determinism apart from to talk about it in the context of how it, like, it determines everything, you know? So it's almost like a kind of statement of, like, you know, it's biased against us, Ben. It's a conspiracy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, because you say that, right? And, like, suddenly, you know, I think what the question itself invites the listener to do is to start thinking in terms of a kind of freedom that actually would be threatened by sort of global cosmic determinism.
I think it just the effect of kind of like saying determinism in that context implies that, like, it elides the fact that you determine you in any way. It like, I think this is the kind of statement who really creates the idea in the mind of determinism as a force. Determinism isn't a force, right? Determinism is like an emergent description of the reality of all the sets of things in the world and their interactions. But it's not some kind of force in of itself. But I think the kind of idea of, like, is freedom compatible with determinism, kind of the actor in that statement becomes determinism, as if it's a thing with powers that does stuff.
Yeah. No, I think that could definitely also happen. I mean, you'll see that with intro students that that, you know, they'll often sort of jump to, okay, if we're to talking, you know, to talking about determinism that way, or maybe even assume that determinism has something to do with the idea of, like, God or fate or something like that, that those are all sort of concepts that it's very easy to run together, you know, to run together in your head. But I mean, I think, like, look, there are things in order to be free to choose your own decisions, you know, through, like, that, you know, you're doing things for, you know, the reasons that you care about, you know, you understand the reasons, you know, you're not, you know, incapacitated, etc. To have that kind of freedom too, there are certainly things you need to be free from, you know, hypnotism, drugs, you know, brainwashing, mind control rays, you know, but
a very serious BDSM kit.
Yes, yes, exactly. But then there aren't really, you know, and those are, I think, the kinds of things that we think that you have to be free from in ordinary everyday attributions of autonomy and responsibility. But then I think when you sort of start saying, it's like, okay, but, you know, what if absolutely everything is determined, even if you do understand it correctly, right? You're not sort of I'm very embarrassed that I can't remember this word, but the you're not like turning a concept into a thing in your head.
Reification.
Thank you. You're not reifying you know, determinism as, like, a thing in itself that's, you know, that's cause and effects, rather than simply the observation that everything is a result of some sort of, you know, cause, you know, some sort of chain of cause and effects. Even if you're not doing that, right? You're not making these mistakes. You know, you understand what's being asked. You know, I think that the framing does still invite you to start thinking in terms of some grandiose notion of freedom that, you know, that, like, you know, freedom from causation, you know, freedom from, you know, physical laws, and that, you know, that the sort of, you know, mistake that I think Slavoj is making in his more recent take on this stuff is that, even though, like, I think he still has a lot of good instincts, and you even see that in the clip we just watched, right? I mean, there's the sort of resistance to saying that, you know, freedom plays out on some sort of spiritual, non-material level of reality. You know,
freedom is a determination is not a word, not a phrase I've heard before, but I quite like it.
Yeah. So, like, even though there are a lot of good instincts on display there, right? I think that like maybe just by virtue of the fact that, like, you know, in his more recent stuff, he's often addressing slightly different questions, right? You know, than he was talking about in that earlier passage. I think that that's sort of led him to do something that, you know, many very smart and perceptive people have been led to do, which is to sort of say, okay, well, whatever this is, it must be something really mysterious. And to then, you know, start to sort of hunt for ways that we could make sense of this, like, mysterious, elusive sense of human freedom. And this is, you know, and in his case, I think hunt in all sorts of interesting places. Again, I find the movie discussions interested. I think that there's, like, some pretty deep waters with the, you know, his kind of take on Hegel here, which connects with some things that he said in lots of other books. There's, you know, even the quantum physics stuff that's, you know, I have the Mark Twain instinct about myself, probably better to, you know, to keep my mouth shut and be thought somebody who doesn't understand that than start spouting off on it and reveal myself as somebody who definitely doesn't understand it. All of these are interesting, and, you know, and I think he has, you know, insightful things to say about many of them. But the question is, well, do you need to do that, right? Do you need to go hunting in all these places for a way to make sense of this? Or were you kind of right the first time, right? And that actually maybe, you know, it's not that deep.
Yeah.
All right. You want to watch a bit more?
Yeah, we can.
Free will.
Oh.
It opens.
Why is he not making noise? Oh, because I muted the site.
Up a space for it in natural reality itself, demonstrating that the image of natural reality as a wholly deterministic space is not true. And the beauty of it, I think, is that you don't need any higher spiritual level here to operate with. You just have to accept, and now we come to the metaphysical beauty of quantum physics. You know, now we live in a wonderful era. Till now, for the last 60, 70 years, the so-called Copenhagen interpretation predominated.
Right.
The basic thesis of Copenhagen interpretation is, as we all know, don't think, just calculate. Copenhagen reading simply prohibited not even the metaphysical, this ontological question. Okay, quantum physics speaks about something, waves, oscillations, collapse of wave function, but what's the ontological status of this? Niels Bohr says, these are just our calculations. The only reality we know is the naive material reality. Naive in the sense that it acts following our common sense. But now things are changing. I love this violent return of metaphysical questions. And you know what's the beauty of it? The standard materialist notion is that reality is spatio-temporal. Object moves in time within space. These two basic coordinates. Now, it's beautiful. There is a big conflict between which is more primordial, space or time. It's a beautiful debate. because it's clear. All and I and in debate with some of them, quantum physicists, they all admit that if we remain within the opposition of time and space, we will not find a solution. So the general opinion is one of the two will have to be abandoned. Abandoned in the sense that it's not an ontologically original dimension. Now, you have...
Somehow supervenes on the other one. Sorry, finish your point.
No. My point is just that Einsteinians are more for space. The idea is, it's beautiful metaphysics, that time is just an effect of our cognitive limitation. Like, I cannot see everything, all of, let's say, your room, so I need time to move from here to there. And it's much more complex, but the basic idea is that the reality itself already exists, everything, what we perceive as past, future, and present, in an atemporal block.
Right.
And that time is just because we are finite beings who cannot grasp it all. But then there are guys, my guys, who claim, no, time is the primordial dimension. And that here, of course, I enter with my speculations, time in the sense of antagonism, Hegelian negativity, and so on and so on.
So comes
second.
Yeah, so like I mean, circling back a little bit though, right? Like on the face of it, you think like if quantum physics is supposed to help with free will, then you know, it's a little bit confusing as to how, because it seems like either you know, like I think Bohr says at some point, you know, they're like hidden variables and it's actually deterministic anyway.
Wait a minute. This is, you touched now a mega problem. The greatness of Bohr is that he rejected hidden variables.
Okay.
Einstein says to account for all this, there must be hidden variables.
Okay.
And the beauty of Bohr is that precisely he daringly asserted an open universe.
Okay.
In reality, reality is incomplete.
Okay. So, fair enough. If you say reality is incomplete, Einstein's wrong, God does play dice with the universe, it seems like then the problem is with that one, then, you know, if there's some sort of quantum randomness that, you know, filters up to decision-making in the human brain, that doesn't really seem like what we want for free will, if there's just some quantum equivalent of a coin flip.
No, I agree with you. Wait a minute. I'm here very careful.
Okay.
I'm not saying that free will is at the same level as quantum contingency oscillations. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that in order for free will not to be just a user's illusion, then somehow reality must not be totally predetermined. Reality must be open. Now, we are far from free will. But in a negative way, if you take the traditional naturalistic notion of universe as a closed deterministic complex, then obviously there is no space of free
will. Well, it's not obvious to everybody, right? This is the, I mean...
How can you do it? Tell me how.
I mean, you be a compatibilist. This is the position you seem to be endorsing, less than nothing, that the you say that you know, you deny that not being predetermined is a condition of free will. That you say free will, or the kind of free will that we care about the most, might be something like, for example, our capacity to consider alternate courses of action, to reflect on and be moved by reasons for and against, you know, those courses of action, et cetera, and that none of that is in conflict with free will. That perhaps, none of that is in conflict with the assumption of physical determinism. That if you, the same that perhaps if you have like, if your conception of, you know, if what you think you need to be in order to be free in the ways that might matter, yeah. certainly for moral evaluation, for responsibility for your actions, if you think that what you need to be free in order to be free in that way is this kind of radical freedom from the laws of physics, then sure, maybe you need this quantum indeterminacy. But I wonder, is that really the kind of freedom that matters on a human level?
No, but this, I think it does. Maybe I change my position. Okay. Because I think that the position that, if I got you correctly, you advocate now, is the position that even if we are at some basic ontological level, just mechanisms, automatic mechanisms determine blah blah. At the level of social life, we experience ourselves as free.
Certainly, yeah.
I think that's not enough.
Well, but it's not just that we experience ourselves as free. I want to be really clear about that, right? Because it's because somebody could say, I agree that that's not very interesting. If all we say is, it seems as if we're free, or maybe it's like a useful illusion rather than a useless one to say that we're free. If that's all you say, then I agree. I agree that that's a very limited interest. But my question is it actually the case that in order to be free, like in other words, in order to objectively be free in the way that matters, you know, there's surely lots of different kinds of freedom or senses of freedom, and I would deny that some of them conflict with the assumption of determinism. But could it be that in order to be free in the way that matters for moral responsibility, for something objectively being your fault or to your credit, you know, when you do it, that for that, right, that the kind of freedom that matters might be not so much freedom from causation, freedom from the laws of physics, but this kind of freedom to determine the course of your life through, as I say, being these capacities to understand and be moved by reasons for and against different courses of action. That seems to be what separates us from other kinds of animals that we wouldn't necessarily think are free in that way. It seems to be the kind of sense in which when we think that people aren't responsible for their actions because they couldn't help it, because they're severely mentally disabled, for example, that seems to be the kind of freedom that they seem to lack, right? So I think the kind of compatibilism that's interesting, and I agree.
I have problems. I see your point now. Yeah. Really. I have problems with compatibilism because still it doesn't explain how the two levels that you treat as compatible relate to each other. Let's return to Daniel Dennett, whom you mentioned. He still insists that if we were to know reality more completely, we would be able to account for all our acts in terms of natural determinism. For him, he even uses sometimes this expression that intentionality. Like when you explain, he gives this example. If I ask you now to do something, to turn off or on your light, the answer, why did you do that, would be because we communicate not at the material level and I ask you to do this. Mm-hmm. But Dennett says that a complete true explanation in the strict scientific sense would have been to describe this at a more elementary level, that I'm telling you something can be translated into how atomic, subatomic particles move, which affect you, and so on. You know, so that for Dennett, nonetheless, the language of intentionality, he gets a little bit ambiguous here, but his basic insight is that the language of intentionality is a kind of a useful simplification. It's beyond the scope of our cognitive capacities to describe all up to the detail that goes physically on. But we are losing time. I want to focus on another point. Sure. I agree with your central point, which is, like, let's say you are oppressed, the police or whoever beats you, bank foreclose your account, blah, blah. So you are in deep shit. You have to do something. What can they do here? This type of metaphysical speculations, are you really free or not? Here I see the danger of artificial intelligence, of brain studies and so on. But what if, and this field is advancing incredibly, what if through direct interventions into your DNA or some more primitive chemical implants into your brain, I can change your character to such a level that you would react differently to such challenges. This is not, and this is far from, this is far from an illusion. I read somewhere, this is the, I think I mentioned this in another of my books, some weird guy with Arab name, I'm not a racist here, just who has a big clinic in Berlin, Germany. Yeah. Already has a project. Instead of maternal womb, he has some kind of a transparent from glass and plastic artificial womb, and he demands from parents of a child, just give me sperm and all that stuff. And then before even the process of birth begins, which is all done in the lab, he gives you, it's pretty terrifying reading, 150 variations where you can make a choice. Not just physical, what color of an eye, how strong will you be, color of your hair, how high, but also psychic properties. Will you be more decisive, aggressive? Will you be more peaceful, and so on and so on? So, you know, here the problem for me enters, because here, okay, you are screwed up by a bank, whoever, police, a gang beats you, but how you will react to it can be already scientifically manipulated. Mm-hmm. So why is this important? Because I learned from my Chinese friends that Chinese biogenetics is focusing on this. How to influence at the level of DNA and so on, how to change what you are biologically, so that to put it in official terminology, to be socially more constructive, not to protest too much, and so on and so on. So here I think that what you are metaphysically like becomes important also in your social behavior. Yes, as you said, you will protest, but if I manipulate your brain enough, you will do a very benevolent protest, or even try to make people more submissive to social norms. You know, this has a long history already in Stalinist Soviet Union, where they tried to. It was done at a much more primitive level, but the idea was that to be a dissident, rebellious behavior means something is wrong with your brain. And they tried to directly intervene into your brain. They treated politically active dissident stance not as, this is beyond the standard Stalinism, not your grandparents must have been bourgeois, bad influence. No, no. Simple, pure biological malfunctioning of your brain. These are, I think, the threats today. But you know, which is another thing, and let's conclude then, if you want this philosophical part, which is important
sure.
for me.
Yes, yes.
It is this opposition between what I call abstract and concrete freedom. Mm-hmm. There are moments of here, if you are looking for my pessimism, you yeah. will find it here. But I point out that there are moments of abstract freedom. These are revolutionary moments where precisely not all, we still speak the same language and so on, but many of basic rules of decency, of nonviolence break down. This is how I read that wonderful quote from Sartre, you know, when he said that already, although under German occupation, the terror was more or less complete,
right. yep.
some sense they were more free more than free, yeah. yes. Why? Precisely because there was no space for freedom within the existing set of rules imposed by the German occupier, you have to think more radically. But another thing here.
Okay, all right. Could probably cut off before the another thing. Just wanted to make sure the last few minutes of that got onto different subjects, but since the subjects were a little tangled up together, wanted to make sure we're getting the whole relevant part of it there. And yeah, I think certainly the first part of what we just watched, I think you got the sort of basic core disagreement.
Some parts of it was just a bit like Zizek, you know, often correctly listing kind of the great mysteries of present day science. Right. Like, is time fundamental or is it an emergent factor because we have an arrow of time or so on and so forth? But it's like, what's this do with human freedom?
Yeah, right. Like, I mean, this is, there's going to be a bunch of, look, you know, you pay your ticket, you take the ride, right? You, you've got, if you're going to talk to them, right, you know, the subjects are going to mix and match in odd ways, and parts of it are going to come to bear, and parts of it really won't, but they'll be interesting. And, you know,
Sean Carroll?
Yeah.
Did you see he did a video of Zizek?
I did not, though.
You should really watch it. Well, I mean, it's enormous, so you have to find the time, but it's very good. I mean, oh, it was meant to be kind of like the interviewer mostly talking to them, but it just ends up Zizek interviewing Sean Carroll.
Yeah, that sounds right. You know, so it's like, look, if you want linearity, he's probably not your guy, but also he's genuinely one of the most interesting human beings to talk to. So, you know, I'll take that particular ride, but yeah. So yes, I agree. Like some of those, you know, some of the stuff about space and time, didn't connect in any obvious way. And, you know, and at the end we were talking about, I still get the connection when we're talking about, brain manipulation and stuff, but then, you know, then we sort of veer off into a bunch of increasingly more political and social things at the end. And
back to Sartre in the end, though.
Yeah, we did briefly get back to Sartre. That was exciting, but not really Sartre's views on free will exactly. So, in kind of authenticity, right? So it's not unrelated, but I think that in but in the most relevant part to the original issue, I was bringing him up and, you know, pressing him on. I think we did get to one of my most, you know, fundamental things, which is just, I don't know. I mean, I think maybe he hasn't read the right compatibilists, that he.
Right. Like, he was still thinking about it in terms of like illusionism.
Yeah. Because he's talking about Dedit, right? So who's the guy he seemed to find convincing in 2012. And, you know, he says much more critical things about in the free will chapter of the new book. And, you know, one of my issues with Dead, and I think this made it into the final version of the essay for today, is that, you know, I haven't read that much Dead It, you know, but from what I have, right, I've looked a little bit at the book from like a year or two ago, the one with Greg Caruso, where they're like the arguing about free will and responsibility. It's, I get the impression that Dennett's position is a little bit ambiguous between, you know, like, okay, Dennett clearly thinks that there is a sense in which you can exercise a certain kind of control, even given determinism, right? He obviously does think that. But some of the formulations I've seen from Dennett are a little ambiguous between thinking that if you exercise that control, you actually are responsible for your behavior, or versus it's sort of useful for promoting good consequences for us to like treat people who exercise that kind of control as being responsible for their behavior, to like attribute responsibility to them or something like that, right? Those are really different positions. And, you know, from what I've seen, I do kind of get the impression, maybe this is unfair, that Dennett goes back and forth between the two a little bit, depending on when he's talking.
I think the main problem with Dennett, as to being read by, you know, say Zizek or whatever, is that, you know, he does a thing which continental philosophers are often accused of being like the only people who do it of, yeah, which is where he'll take a common word with a common meaning, and then he'll use it in a weird way in his text, which if you read all his definitions and all his works, it makes complete sense what he's saying. But when he, if you then translate it, just, you don't translate and just say it as it was in English, it's like nonsense. He's like, oh yeah, we have freedom, but consciousness is an illusion. It's like, well, where does freedom live if consciousness is an illusion? But of course, by consciousness is an illusion, he actually just means that consciousness doesn't work like how you think it works.
Right.
And human freedom doesn't work like how you think it works, but it exists. And he, by illusion, he means something which does exist rather than doesn't.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So that is a as they say, a whole nother thing. I'm not gonna make any attempt to weigh in ignorance about all that. My Dennett lore doesn't go that deep, but. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like I give the example in the essay of, you know, John Martin Fisher, who I think has really useful things to say, that, you know, that if, you know, Zizek may be interacting with some of that rather than Dennett, it at least might sort of, you know, give him a kind of more useful, you know, a more useful sense of like where, like a reasonable compatibilist position is set, right? So so what somebody like Fisher will say is, look, I'm not even trying to save, you know, freedom to do otherwise, you know, which I will say, this is not Fisher, this is me, parenthetically, I think maybe you can save, but like we've talked about this before, but you know, Fisher's not even trying to save it because he's very convinced by like, you know, Frankfurt cases where, you know, there are a million versions of this case, but they're all some, you know, but the sort of basic idea is that there's this guy Jones who's going to do something or not do it. And there's a hypothetical intervener Black who will step in, if it looks like Jones isn't going to make the decision that Black wants him to make, and like intervene to, you know, manipulate his brain or whatever he has to do to make sure that Jones does make the decision he wants him to make. And, you know, Frankfurt's conclusion from thinking about Frankfurt cases, and certainly Fisher's conclusion, is that, well, in a case like this, right, a case where Black does not intervene. So Fisher's main original essay about this, I think also called Alternate Possibilities, More Responsibility, but it has It's kind of funny because his big, you know, his example in there is all about Jones deciding who to vote for in the 1992 election. And that actually doesn't strike me as a terribly morally weighted decision, because it's like, yeah, George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton, you know, real clash of, you know, very different ideological visions there. But in any case, but he has Black wanting Jones to vote for Clinton. And if Black wants, you know, if Jones starts to, if Jones had started to, you know, do something that indicated, you know, in whatever way, maybe, you know, Black is brain scanning him the whole time, right? That indicated the possibility that he might decide to vote for Bush, then Black would intervene neurochemically to make him do it. But as a matter of fact, Jones doesn't do that, right? Jones just votes for Clinton and Black never has to intervene. And, you know, Jones is making his decision in the normal way, like anybody would. And we're not assuming anything one way or the other about causal determinism or anything like that. We're just, you know, just ordinary gardenly variety experience. Well, Frankfurt and Fisher's point is, if you would think that Jones is responsible for this absent Black, right, then the introduction of Black doesn't seem to change anything, because it has absolutely nothing to do with the chain of cause and effect that actually leads to his decision. And so what they conclude from this is that freedom to do otherwise doesn't really seem like the sort of free will that matters for moral responsibility, that like the sort of control over your actions that matters for moral responsibility isn't about, you know, what would have happened in some alternate possibility or anything like that. And therefore that it doesn't really matter if determinism closes off those alternate possibilities, right? That's their view. There's a lot you could say about this, because obviously people have raised many, many objections to this argument and there are interesting responses to the objections, but just skipping right over all of that. Then the question is, well, what kind of control do you need to exercise over your actions to be, you know, truly objectively responsible for it? Not just, you know, not just a socially beneficial illusion, but like you actually are responsible. You actually are a person. Then he starts getting into all the stuff that we talked about earlier about responsiveness to reasons. And, you know, I bring all this up not just because that happens to be the view that I more or less agree with, but at least as far as what the conditions are for the kind of autonomy that seems to really matter for moral responsibility and personhood. But because I think that this is, you know, I just, you know, I think that the that if what you're sort of interacting with is Dennett having this very idiosyncratic cluster of concepts that leaves you a little bit unclear at the end, whether he even actually means real full-on compatibilism, or whether ultimately all these concepts kind of add up to you might as well talk as if you are, or something like that. I think if you're interacting with something like that, which is like a very clear kind of compatibilist view, I think it at least kind of helps to clarify what should be argued against. And I guess the last point I would make about this is just that on the question he raises in there, in the discussion about levels, I don't particularly see a big problem there, because or I guess to be more careful about this, I think to see a problem there, you would have to have some like pretty extreme skepticism about ordinary mental concepts. You would basically have to be a member of the Churchland family to see a problem here, right? Because it's like, because I think the sort of, you know, it's like, yes, you're right, at the level of, you know, subatomic particles or even neurons, we're not talking like Sure, those are things that don't have free will. You know, they're also invisible, but you put a whole bunch of them together and they're visible, right? Lots of things have lots of properties.
And, right. Some atomic particles can't get wet.
Yes, exactly. And yet,
I remember once on Reddit Ask Philosophy, someone was trying to make the point that like composites would always have the properties of the things that they're composed of. And I was like, so you're saying that galaxies are wet because some of the things in them are wet? And he was like, yes.
See, that's some real internet philosophy there. Not just like, there's also like a particular kind of internet philosophy where like the sort of what counts as like a kind of intellectual virtue gets completely flipped. That it's not that like, it's not that the criteria for success is that you've said things that sort of fit together in a way that's plausibly true, but instead the criteria of success is that, you know, you said something that's extremely based, and the thing that makes it.
I was going to say he did Chad yes me and he did win morally.
Yeah, exactly right. Like, you know, yeah, when you get to do the like. So you're saying galaxies are wet, Chad? Yes, right. That's like a win because, like, you know, because it's like because it's so base that you said something so implausible and stuck with it.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually thinking earlier that, in a very kind of stupid sense, reductive physicalists are panpsychists.
Okay.
In the sense that they think the basic, in the sense that, you know. We talk about two kinds of panpsychism, one where everything is mind, which is stupid, and one where, like, within everything there is the building blocks of mind, and as you get more and more together, you get more mind.
Okay,
Yeah, and physicalists are panpsychists in the sense that they think in that subatomic particles are constitutive of the building blocks of mind, and that there's nothing else involved.
Yeah, no, I like it. That's true. Yeah, that's fun.
And I guess are all the fundamental particles in your brain? I've got no idea.
Okay, well, further research needed to see if all the fundamental particles are in your brain. Otherwise, this might not quite work.
Do I have electrons in my brain which aren't made of quarks?
Yeah, exactly. Oh my god. Yeah. You know, I will note that in that discussion I was being very careful not to assent to the premise that electrons are made of quarks, not because I actually knew it was false. I did not. But just because I was like afraid that I might be saying something false if I affirmed the premise.
Yeah, but, like, as soon as I said that I had doubts. I was like, oh fuck.
Yeah. Well, you know. Nothing compared to my shame for saying Bohr when I met Bohm in the discussion with Slavoj, but
I can't remember the difference between those two. It's funny though, the Nobel Prize was about Bell's theorem for the other B-man.
Okay.
And it was about local hidden variables, eliminating some theories of local hidden variables, and about proving that. It's funny, like, there's lots of things in physics which, like, we've proved this 100% and they've never done a practical experiment.
Yeah.
But like it really, really fits. And when we do them, it definitely will be. And the Nobel Prize was for them doing one of these with quantum entanglement. It's got quantum entanglement and hidden variables and so on.
Yeah.
It was interesting. I thought he was about to bring up many worlds there when he was talking about the Copenhagen.
Because that would have definitely fit the sort of drift of what he was saying about, you know, people, you know, for the longest time, you know, Copenhagen was incredibly dominant, you know, but now that would have made sense.
It would perfectly fit with what Sean Carroll says, because Sean Carroll makes this massive point of being like, you know, we have these equations, but basically we don't know what they mean. And we use them and they work perfectly, but we don't really understand them. And that's an enormous embarrassment for physics. And that's why you want, you know, the many worlds interpretation to win out, because and it's the one he agrees with.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I am actually definitely going to watch that. That sounds fun. But yeah, gonna take, just as I did last December, going to, take a few weeks off of YouTubery. So, people will have to do without us. We will have like a, you know, clip on the channel, assuming you're watching this on GTA at least once every couple days during the break. And we are even going to be recording just a little bit of new stuff to put out during that period. But, and if you're, you know, watching this on TIR, they never take breaks. They're, you know, there's new TIR content, you know, once an hour on the hour, 365 days a year, but
gas breaks.
yeah, exactly. All right. We'll see you in 2024.
Wow. The future is now.